A Pink Blossom on a Blue Speech Bubble, Magnolia Pictures. A book opens. On its blank pages, city skyscrapers assemble out of steel beams and stone. Our view sweeps down toward the streets, which unfurl like rolls of carpet. The sky grows dusky as a brightly lit cinema appears. Amazon Studios. Images align to form the dot over a letter I, independent lens. Shards converge to form triangles. Velvet film, Paris, New York, Port-au-Prince. Titles appear. Velvet Film Incorporated USA and Velvet Film France present. In co-production with Artemis Productions, Close Up Films, Arte France, Independent Lens, RTS Radio Television Suisse, RTBF Television Belge, and Shelter Productions. Text on screen. In June 1979, acclaimed author James Baldwin commits to a complex endeavor. Tell his story of America through the lives of three of his murdered friends, Medgar Evers, Martin Luther King Jr., and Malcolm X. Baldwin never got past his 30 pages of notes entitled, Remember This House. Text on screen, The Dick Cavett Show, 1968.
Mr. Baldwin, I'm sure you still meet the remark that, what are the Negroes, why aren't they optimistic? They say, but it's getting so much better. There are Negro mayors, there's Negroes in all of sports, there are Negroes in politics, they're even accorded the ultimate accolade of being in television commercials now.
Baldwin rubs his chin and smiles broadly.
I'm glad you're smiling. Is it at once getting much better and still hopeless?
Well, I don't think there's much hope for it, you know, to tell you the truth. You know, as long as people are using this peculiar language.
Cavett glances off camera.
There's a question of what happens to the Negro here, or to the black man here. That's a very vivid question for me, you know. But the real question is what's going to happen to this country. I have to repeat that.
Police in riot gear aim rifles. A black man holds his hands up as tear gas clouds the night. An officer behind a riot shield screams. A young black man screams at a police cordon. An officer pulls a man in a drenched t-shirt. The man's dreadlocks hang over his face. A black officer pins a black man to the ground. A woman in a pink hoodie gestures toward the police behind her. A woman puts her hands on her head. The American flag before her, a Black Lives Matter banner behind her, a building burns. A title, I Am Not Your Negro. Written by James Baldwin. I stopped by my daughter's house. Directed by Raoul Peck.
To J. Acton, Spartan Literary Agency, June 30th, 1979. My dear Jay, I'll confess to you that I am writing the enclosed proposal in a somewhat divided frame of mind.
A city street under elevated train tracks.
The summer has scarcely begun, and I feel already that it's almost over. And I will be 55. Yes, 55 in a month. I am about to undertake the journey. And this is a journey, to tell you the truth, which I always knew that I would have to make, but had hoped, perhaps, certainly hadn't hoped, not to have to make so soon.
Broken sunlight reaches the street below the tracks.
I am saying that a journey is called that because you cannot know what you will discover on the journey, what you will do with what you find, or what you find will do to you.
Martin Luther King Jr.
We not only have a right to be free, we have a duty to be free.
Yeah.
And so when you sit down on the bus and you sit down in the front or you sit down by a white person, you're sitting down because you have a duty to sit down, not merely because you have a right.
Text, Montgomery bus boycott.
The time of these lives and deaths from a public point of view is 1955, when we first heard of Martin, to 1968, when he was murdered.
Dr. King's wife and children view his body in a casket.
Medgar was murdered in the summer of 1963. Malcolm was murdered in 1965.
A photo of Medgar Evers in a casket at his funeral. An autopsy photo of Malcolm X. In black and white photos, Medgar gazes at the camera. Malcolm holds two young daughters. Martin waves from a car, two children in the back seat.
The three men, Medgar, Malcolm, and Martin, were very different men. Consider that Martin was only 26 in 1955. He took on his shoulders the weight of the crimes and the lies and the hope of a nation.
Martin reaches out from a car as many hands reach back.
I want these three lives to bang against and reveal each other, as in truth they did, and use their dreadful journey as a means of instructing the people whom they loved so much, who betrayed them, and for whom they gave their lives.
An elevated train passes a brick building. Chapter title, Paying My Dues. A station wagon labeled U.S. Army pulls up beside a battalion of armed soldiers. Leander Perez, White Citizens Council.
The moment a Negro child walks into the school, every decent, self-respecting, loving parent should take his white child out of that parochial school.
A white teenage boy holds a hand-painted sign. We won't go to school with Negroes. Friends on either side hold their own signs. Strike against integration. Don't want Negroes in our school. Text, Central High School, Little Rock, Arkansas, 1957. Black teens emerge from the Army station wagon. Local police hold the white protesters back. Army soldiers escort the black students past the crowds into the school.
God forgives murder and he forgives adultery. But he is very angry and he actually curses all who do integrate.
The protesters surge forward, breaking past police cordons. One man tackles another on a grassy slope. In a photo, a teen holds up fingers behind a young black woman's head, suggesting horns.
That's when I saw the photograph. On every newspaper kiosk on that wide tree-shaped boulevard in Paris were photographs of 15-year-old Dorothy Counts being reviled and spat upon by the mob as she was making her way to school in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Dozens crowd behind her.
There was unutterable pride, tension, and anguish in that girl's face as she approached the halls of learning with history jeering at her back.
Two teens' faces contort as they yell towards her.
It made me furious. It filled me with both hatred and pity, and it made me ashamed. Some one of us should have been there with her.
Dorothy sits in an auditorium surrounded by hundreds of laughing classmates.
But it was on that bright afternoon that I knew I was leaving France. I could simply no longer sit around Paris discussing the Algerian and the black American problem. Everybody else was paying their dues, and it was time I went home and paid mine.
If you was white, you'd be all right.
Images. A Negro character with a straw hat and white eyes appears in an ad for shoes. A black maid washes dishes. A speech balloon reads, "I sure got a good job now." A heavy black maid marvels at a refrigerator. In an ad for Maxwell House, a man in blackface exclaims, "Folks just can't help having a friendly feeling for this here coffee." A tuxedoed slave serves antebellum ladies and gentlemen.
If you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around.
A black bellhop delivers Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. A black teen beams proudly at a tray of Big Macs. Neon signs. The Cold Stone Creamery. Dallas Barbecue. A Regal Theater. Glowing electronic billboards advertise The Lion King, Kinky Boots.
I had at last come home. If there was in this some illusion, there was also much truth.
An American flag in lights.
In the years in Paris, I had never been homesick for anything American. Neither waffles, ice cream, hot dogs, baseball, majorettes, movies, nor the Empire State Building, nor Coney Island, nor the Statue of Liberty, nor the Daily News, nor Times Square. All of these things had passed out of me. They might never have existed. And it made absolutely no difference to me if I never saw them again.
A subway train rolls on elevated tracks. In grainy footage, passengers gaze out the open windows of a train as it passes overhead. On a street below.
But I missed my brothers and sisters and my mother.
Women in dresses.
They made a difference.
Men were suspenders.
I wanted to be able to see them and to see their children.
Children play in the street.
I hoped that they wouldn't forget me. I missed Harlem Sunday mornings and fried chicken and biscuits. I missed the music.
A woman wears a kerchief over her curlers.
I missed the style. That style possessed by no other people in the world.
Women board a bus.
I miss the way the dark face closes, the way dark eyes watch, and the way when a dark face opens, a light seems to go everywhere.
A crowded nightclub.
I missed, in short, my connections. Missed the life which had produced me and nourished me and paid for me. Now, though I was a stranger, I was home.
A man in silhouette gazes down from a large window, his foot on the sill. In the black and white film, Chorus Girls Tap Dance. A title, Dance Fools Dance, 1931.
I am fascinated by the movement on and off the screen.
The lead dancer catches a man's eye.
I'm about 7. I'm with my mother or my aunt. The movie is Dance Fools Dance.
She swings her arms and legs wildly and swivels her hips. Smoke rises from tables full of well-dressed men and women.
I was aware that Joan Crawford was a white lady. Yet, I remember being sent to the store sometime later, and a colored woman, who to me looked exactly like Joan Crawford, was buying something. She was incredibly beautiful. She looked down at me with so beautiful a smile. And I was not even embarrassed, which was rare for me.
Chapter title, Heroes. In black and white footage, an American flag hangs limply over a classroom of black children.
By this time, I had been taken in hand by a young white school teacher named Bill Miller, a beautiful woman, very important to me.
One boy sleeps on his desk.
She gave me books to read and talked to me about the books. And about the world.
A royal family poses on thrones.
About Ethiopia and Italy and the German Third Reich.
Teens wave swastika flags.
And took me to see plays and films to which no one else would have dreamed of taking a 10-year-old boy.
People toss books onto a bonfire. In another film, shirtless black characters dance around their white blonde captive. Title, King Kong, 1933.
It is certainly because of Bill Miller, who arrived in my terrifying life so soon, that I never really managed to hate white people.
The natives beat drums.
Though God knows, I have often wished to murder more than one or two.
The natives, wearing white face paint and grass skirts, tie the blonde woman to a platform.
Therefore, I begin to suspect that white people did not act as they did because they were white, but for some other reason.
In the black and white photo, a white woman smiles with a group of black teens.
I was a child, of course, and therefore unsophisticated. I took Bill Miller as she was, or as she appeared to be to me. She too, anyway, was treated like a nigger, especially by the cops. And she had no love for landlords.
Richard!
Title, Richard's Answer, 1945.
Richard! Can't get him up. Richard! Can't get him up.
In these days, no one resembling my father has yet made an appearance on the American cinema scene.
A black man in a long stocking cap sits up in bed.
No, it's not entirely true. There were, for example, Step and Fetch It and Willie Best and Mantan Moreland, all of whom, rightly or wrongly, I loathed. It seemed to me that they lied about the world I knew and debased it.
In The Monster Walks, 1932, a wide-eyed man has his foot caught in the jaws of a bearskin rug.
For it is also possible that their comic bug-eyed terror contained the truth concerning a terror by which I hoped never to be engulfed. Yet, I had no reservations at all concerning the terror of the black janitor, and they won't forget.
Text, 1937.
Give me the police. Give me the police. I think that it was a black actor named Clinton Rosemond who played this part. And he looked a little like my father.
Police surround the man in a jail cell.
I didn't do it.
He is terrified because a young white girl in this small southern town has been raped and murdered, and her body has been found on the premises of which he is the janitor.
Good morning, Dump.
A pot-bellied white lawyer.
Dump.
The role of the janitor is small. Yet the man's face bangs in my memory until today.
Nobody says you have, Tom, but they might.
The film's icy brutality both scared me and strengthened me.
A white man uses a whip. Title, Uncle Tom's Cabin, 1927. A title card, he's done, Fo Massa. The white man, take him out. Two slaves carry a third out of the room. Later, the whipped man lies in bed. He gazes heavenward. I forgive you as I hope to be forgiven.
Because Uncle Tom refuses to take vengeance in his own hands, he was not a hero for me.
Title, Stagecoach, 1939.
Heroes, as far as I could see, were white, and not merely because of the movies, but because of the land in which I lived, of which movies were simply a reflection.
White men fight off Indians.
I despised and feared those heroes because they did take vengeance into their own hands. They thought vengeance was theirs to take.
John Wayne fires from the speeding coach.
I understood that. My countrymen were my enemy.
The Indians and their horses fall, tumbling over the dusty ground. Now, a lush green field at dusk. A layer of mist clings to the ground.
I suspect that all these stories are designed to reassure us that no crime was committed. We've made a legend out of a massacre.
Title, Cambridge University Debate, 1965, James Baldwin.
Leaving aside all the physical facts which one can quote, leaving aside rape or murder, leaving aside the bloody catalog of oppression, which we are in one way too familiar with already, what this does to the subjugated is to destroy his sense of reality. This means, in the case of an American Negro, born in that glittering republic, and in the moment you are born, since you don't know any better, every stick and stone and every face is white.
A black child stands among white mannequins in a shop.
You suppose that you are too. It comes as a great shock around the age of 5 or 6 or 7 to discover that Gary Cooper killing off the Indians when you were rooting for Gary Cooper, that the Indians were you. It comes as a great shock to discover that the country which is your birthplace and to which you owe your life and your identity has not in its whole system of reality evolved any place for you.
A black boy wears a cowboy hat. A letter to Jay Acton, Spartan Literary Agency.
My dear Jay, you must, it is to be hoped, be as curious as I am concerning the execution of this book project. I know how to do it, technically. It is a matter of research and journeys. And with you or without you, I will do it anyway.
Brain splatters a windshield.
I begin in September when I go on the road. The road means my return to the South. It means briefly, for example, seeing Merle Evers and the children, those children who are children no longer.
A woman wipes a boy's tears.
It means going back to Atlanta, to Selma, to Birmingham.
A woman wears a corsage.
It means seeing Coretta Scott King and Martin's children. I know that Martin's daughter, whose name I don't remember, and Malcolm's oldest daughter, whose name is Atala, are both in the theater and apparently are friends. It means seeing Betty Shabazz, Malcolm's widow, and the 5 younger children. It means exposing myself as one of the witnesses to the lives and deaths of their famous fathers. And it means much, much more than that. A clod of witnesses, as old St. Paul once put it.
Chapter title, Witness.
I first met Malcolm X. I saw Malcolm before I met him. I was giving a lecture somewhere in New York. Malcolm was sitting in the first row of the hall, bending forward at such an angle that his long arms nearly caressed the ankles of his long legs, staring up at me. I very nearly panicked. I knew Malcolm only by legend, and this legend, since I was a Harlem street boy, I was sufficiently astute to distrust.
Malcolm X's eyes crinkle behind his Ray-Bans.
Malcolm might be the torch that white people claim he was, though, in general, white America's evaluations of these matters would be laughable and even pathetic did not these evaluations have such wicked results. On the other hand, Malcolm had no reason to trust me either. And so I stumbled through my lecture, with Malcolm never taking his eyes from my face.
Our view sweeps past rows of stately homes, a brick Georgian with a two-story tall portico, a colonial home with a second-story balcony overlooking palm trees, and another home, curved steps lead to a six-column portico backed by floor-to-ceiling windows. Elsewhere, a man waves from the stoop of a one-story hovel with sagging brick walls and a sheet metal-patched roof. Medgar faces a bank of microphones at a table.
As a member of the NAACP, Medgar was investigating the murder of a black man, which had occurred months before. Had shown me letters from black people asking him to do this, and he had asked me to come with him.
In footage, Baldwin watches out the window of a moving car.
I was terribly frightened. But perhaps that field trip will help us define what I mean by the word witness.
He watches people go about business on a sidewalk.
I was to discover that the line which separates a witness from an actor is a very thin line indeed. Nevertheless, the line is real. I was not, for example, a black Muslim. In the same way, though for different reasons, that I never became a Black Panther, because I did not believe that all white people were devils, and I did not want young black people to believe that. I was not a member of any Christian congregation because I knew that they had not heard and did not live by the commandment, love one another as I love you. And I was not a member of the NAACP. Because in the North, where I grew up, the NAACP was fatally entangled with black class distinctions, or illusions of the same, which repelled a Shushan boy like me.
Armed officers approach six black men.
I did not have to deal with the criminal state of Mississippi hour by hour and day by day, to say nothing of night after night. I did not have to sweat cold sweat after decisions involving hundreds of thousands of lives. I was not responsible for raising money, for deciding how to use it. I was not responsible for strategy controlling prayer meetings, marches, petitions, voting registration drives. I saw the sheriffs, the deputies, the storm troopers more or less in passing. I was never in town to stay. This was sometimes hard on my morale, but I had had to accept as time wore on that part of my responsibility as a witness was to move as largely and as freely as possible, to write the story and to get it out.
A New Yorker magazine article, Letter from a Region in My Mind. The article begins with a Kipling poem, "Take up the white man's burden, ye dare not stoop to less." Text, March 1966, FBI memorandum. Information concerning James Arthur Baldwin to Assistant FBI Director Alan Rosen. Bureau files reveal that Baldwin, a Negro author, was born in New York City and has lived and traveled in Europe. He has become rather well known due to his writing dealing with the relationship of white and Negroes. It has been heard that Baldwin may be an homosexual, and he appeared as if he may be one. Text, FBI head J. Edgar Hoover.
We should all be concerned with but one goal, the eradication of crime. The Federal Bureau of Investigation is as close to you as your nearest telephone. It seeks to be your protector in all matters within its jurisdiction. It belongs to you.
Signs at a protest. Race mixing is communism. Stop the race mixing. The memo continues. Information collected clearly depicted the subject as a dangerous individual who could be expected to commit acts inimical to the national defense and public safety to the United States in times of emergency. Consequently, his name is being included in the Security Index. A A rocket with the words United States across the cone-shaped capsule at its tip rises alongside a launch tower. Vapor pours down the side of the slender rocket. Exhaust billows up from the engine's fiery plume. In space, the sun slowly emerges from behind an enormous dusty orange sphere.
White people are astounded by Birmingham. Black people aren't.
Our view skims over a barren surface.
White people are endlessly demanding to be reassured that Birmingham is really on Mars.
A landscape scarred with craters and deep fissures.
They don't want to believe, still less to act on the belief that what is happening in Birmingham is happening all over the country.
White men beat fellow citizens at an assembly.
They don't want to realize that there is not one step morally or actually between Birmingham and Los Angeles.
In a photo, white men stand over a black man who clutches his head on the ground. In another photo, a white man kicks a fallen man as others look on. In color footage, Martin Luther King Jr. leads whites and blacks in a march. Text, the Birmingham Campaign, Alabama, 1963. People sing in church pews. An officer pushes a black man back. Another uses his baton to shove encroaching blacks away from a building. The marchers step back, unresisting. Officers usher dozens of clapping women into a prison bus. A man with a megaphone stops a line of marchers on a sidewalk. A broadcast. Dr. Kenneth Clark, The Negro and the American Promise, 1963.
We've invited three men on the forefront of the Negro struggle to sit down and talk with us in front of the television camera. Each of these men, through his actions and his words.
Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., and James Baldwin.
Is a spokesman for some segment of the Negro people today.
Malcolm.
Black people in this country have been the victims of violence at the hands of the white man for 400 years. And following the ignorant Negro preachers, we have thought that it was godlike to turn the other cheek to the brute that was brutalizing us.
Malcolm X, one of the most articulate exponents of the Black Muslim philosophy.
Now, with Martin.
Has said of your movement and your philosophy that it plays into the hands of the white oppressors, that they are happy to hear you talk about love for the oppressor because this disarms the Negro and fits into the stereotype of the Negro as a meek, turning the other cheek sort of creature. Would you care to comment on Mr. X's belief?
Well, I don't think of love as, in this context, as emotional bosh. But I think of love as something strong and that organizes itself into powerful, direct action. Now, this is what I've tried to teach in this struggle in the South, that we are not engaged in a struggle that means we sit down and do nothing. There's a great deal of difference between non-resistance to evil and non-violent resistance.
Malcolm.
Martin Luther King is just a 20th century or modern Uncle Tom or a religious Uncle Tom who is doing the same thing today to keep Negroes defenseless in the face of attack that Uncle Tom did on the plantation to keep those Negroes defenseless in the face of the attack of the Klan in that day.
Martin.
I think, though, that we can be sure that the vast majority of Negroes who engage in the demonstrations and who understand the nonviolent philosophy will be able to face dogs and all of the other brutal methods that are used without retaliating with violence, because they understand that one of the first principles of nonviolence is a willingness to be the recipient of violence while never inflicting violence upon another.
Malcolm holds a newspaper headline, "Our freedom can't wait."
As concerns Malcolm and Martin, I watched two men coming from unimaginably different backgrounds, whose positions originally were poles apart, driven closer and closer together.
Malcolm's mugshot.
By the time each died, their positions had become virtually the same position.
The men shake hands.
It can be said, indeed, that Martin picked up Malcolm's burden, articulated the vision which Malcolm had begun to see and for which he paid with his life, and that Malcolm was one of the people Martin saw on the mountaintop. Medgar was too young to have seen this happen, though he hoped for it and would not have been surprised. But Medgar was murdered first.
Medgar, a young man, sits on a couch with his wife.
I was older than Medgar, Malcolm, and Martin. I was raised to believe that the eldest was supposed to be a model for the younger, and was, of course, expected to die first. Not one of these three lived to be 40.
White protesters pump their fists. Priests and nuns walk silently past them and their handwritten signs. White power, stop the red invasion. Police in blue helmets hold back the protesters. A sign features a black ape-like caricature with the slogan, "Kiss me, I'm equal." A man swings a baseball bat. Allies surround Martin as they march. Martin cringes, then straightens, gazing at a mass of whites keeping pace on a sidewalk. They hold signs with swastikas. Malcolm gives a speech.
We need an organization that no one downtown loves. We need one that's ready and willing to take action. Any kind of action, by any means necessary.
In an interview, James Baldwin rubs his forehead.
When Malcolm talks, or one of the Muslim ministers talk, they articulate for all the Negro people who hear them, who listen to them. They articulate their suffering, the suffering which has been in this country so long denied. That's Malcolm's great authority over any of his audiences. He corroborates their reality. He tells them that they really exist, you know?
Text, Ferguson, Missouri, August 2014. At night, people run through plumes of tear gas in a street. A woman carries a preschool-aged girl on her shoulders as they march. Someone holds an upside-down American flag. An officer aims his assault weapon. Others carry a person from the scene. An armored vehicle moves through the street, a gunner peering up from a hatch on top. James Baldwin.
And there are days, this is one of them, when you wonder what your role is in this country and what your future is in it. How precisely you're going to reconcile yourself to your situation here, and how you're going to communicate to the vast, heedless, unthinking, cruel white majority that you are here. I'm terrified at the moral apathy, the death of the heart, which is happening in my country. These people have deluded themselves for so long that they really don't think I'm human. I had basis on their conduct, not on what they say. And this means that they have become, in themselves, moral monsters.
Tourists sit on bleachers under palm trees. They aim cameras at water skiers posing on a green lawn. The six white women wear matching white swimsuits. The four white men wear black trunks. They pose with water skis and wave to the crowds. Young white women in matching white blouses run under a sunny blue sky. Vivid red lipstick highlights their broad smiles. A breeze ruffles their silky styled hair. Text, Florida Forum, 1963. James Baldwin.
Most of the white Americans I've ever encountered, really, you know, had a Negro friend or a Negro maid or somebody in high school, but they never, you know, or rarely, after school was over or whatever, you know, came to my kitchen. You know, we were segregated from the schoolhouse door. Therefore, he doesn't know. He really does not know what it was like for me to leave my house, you know, leave the school and go back to Harlem. He doesn't know how Negroes live. And it comes as a great surprise to the Kennedy brothers and to everybody else in the country. I'm certain, again, you know, that like most white Americans I have, you know, encountered, they have no, I'm sure they have nothing whatever against Negroes. That's really not the question. You know, the question is really a kind of apathy and ignorance, which is a price we paid for segregation. That's what segregation means. You don't know what's happening on the other side of the wall because you don't want to know.
I was, in some way, in those years, without entirely realizing it, the great black hope of the great white father. I was not a racist, or so I thought. Malcolm, was a racist, or so they thought. In fact, we were simply trapped in the same situation.
Text, A Raisin in the Sun, 1961.
Will you tell that to my boy tonight when you put him to sleep on the living room couch? And you tell it to him in the morning when his mother goes out of here to take care of somebody else's kids, and tell it to me when we want some curtains or some drapes and you sneak out of here and go work in somebody's kitchen. All I want is to make a future for this family. All I want is to be able to stand in front of my boy like my father never was able to do to me.
I must sketch now the famous Bobby Kennedy meeting.
A black woman smiles in an office.
Lorraine Hansberry would not be very much younger than I am now if she were alive. At the time of the Bobby Kennedy meeting, she was 33.
She poses, arms crossed over her typewriter.
That was one of the very last times I saw her on her feet, and she died at the age of 34. I miss her so much.
Bobby Kennedy walks outdoors, escorted by over a dozen men.
People forget how young everybody was. Bobby Kennedy, for another quite different example, was 38. We wanted him to tell his brother, the president, to personally escort to school on that day or the day after a small black girl already scheduled to enter Deep South School. That way, we said, it will be clear that whoever spits on that child will be spitting on the nation. He didn't understand this either. It would be, he said, a meaningless moral gesture. We would like, said Lorraine, from you a moral commitment. He looked insulted, seemed to feel that he'd been wasting his time. Well, Lorraine sat still, watching all the while. She looked at Bobby Kennedy, who perhaps for the first time looked at her. But I'm very worried, she said, about the state of the civilization which produced that photograph of the white cop standing on that Negro woman's neck in Birmingham.
Five cops surround the woman on the ground. One kneels on her neck.
Then she smiled, and I am glad that she was not smiling at me. Goodbye, Mr. Attorney General, she said, and turned and walked out of the room. And then we heard the thunder.
A headline, Lorraine Hansberry, 34, dies, author of A Raisin in the Sun.
The very last time I saw Medgar Evers, he stopped at his house on the way to the airport so I could autograph my books for him, his wife, and children. I remember Merle Evers standing outside, smiling, and we waved. And Medgar drove to the airport and put me on the plane.
A ranch house with a carport bears a historical plaque.
Months later, I was in Puerto Rico working on my play. Lucianne and I had spent a day or so wandering around the island, and now we were driving home.
Our view sweeps past palm trees at dusk.
It was a wonderful, bright, sunny day. Top of the car was down. We were laughing, talking, and the radio was playing. Then the music stopped. And a voice announced that Medgar Evers had been shot to death in the carport of his home, and his wife and children had seen the big man fall.
An investigator pulls a rifle from a tangle of weeds. A headline, rifle found, believed gun that killed Evers. Text, Don't Look Back, 1967, Bob Dylan.
But when the shadowy sun sits on the one that fired the gun, you'll see by his grave, on the stone that remains, carved next to his name, is Epitaph plain, only upon...
A man stands by an open casket as Merle Evers leans down to kiss her late husband's forehead.
The blue sky seemed to descend like a blanket, and I couldn't say anything. I couldn't cry. I just remembered his face, a bright, blunt, handsome face, and his weariness, which he wore like his skin, and the way he said, "Road," for road. And his telling me how the tatters of clothes from a lynched body hung, flapping in the tree for days, and how he had to pass that tree every day. Medgar, gone.
Moss hangs from the branches of massive trees that hang over a glassy swamp.
In America, I was free only in battle, never free to rest. And he who finds no way to rest cannot long survive the battle.
In the movie still, a white man wearing a loincloth stands on a tree branch overseeing the forest. In another movie still, white women wearing leopard print mini dresses hold spears and bows.
And a young white revolutionary remains in general far more romantic than a black one. White people have managed to get through entire lifetimes in this euphoric state. But black people have not been so lucky. A black man who sees the world the way John Wayne, for example, sees it, would not be an eccentric patriot, but a raving maniac.
A woman holds a sign, "Nigger, don't you wish you were white?"
The truth is that this country does not know what to do with its black population, dreaming of anything like the final solution.
A black man in a striped uniform lies on the ground, his hands and feet bound to a pickaxe.
The Negro has never been as docile as white Americans wanted you to be.
James Baldwin.
That was a myth. We were not singing and dancing down the levee. We were trying to keep alive. We were trying to survive a very brutal system. The Negro has never been happy in this place.
Young black boys in bunny suits hop in a circle. One bends over, laughing at his puffy tail.
One of the most terrible things is that, in fact, whether I like it or not, I am an American. My school really was the streets of New York City. My frame of reference was George Washington and John Wayne. But I was a child. You know, a child opens his eyes in the world, he has to use what he sees. There's nothing else to use. And you are formed by what you see, the choices you have to make, and the way you discover what it means to be black in New York. And then throughout the entire country.
Black children gaze through a fence. Two boys aim toy guns.
I know how you watch as you grow older. And this is not a figure of speech. The corpses of your brothers and your sisters pile up around you. And not for anything they have done. They were too young to have done anything.
Portraits. Tamir Rice, Darius Simmons, Trayvon Martin.
When you try to stand up and look the world in the face like you had a right to be here.
Ayanna Stanley Jones.
You have attacked the entire power structure of the Western world.
Christopher McCray, Cameron Tillman, Amir Brooks.
Forget the Negro problem. Don't write any voting acts. We had that, it's called the 15th Amendment. During the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, what you had to look at is what is happening in this country. And what is really happening is a brother has murdered brother knowing it was his brother. White men have lynched Negroes knowing them to be their sons. White women have had Negroes burned knowing them to be their lovers. It is not a racial problem. It's a problem whether or not you're willing to look at your life and be responsible for it and then begin to change it. That great Western house I come from is one house, and I am one of the children of that house. Cindy, I'm the most despised child of that house. And it is because the American people are unable to face the fact that, in fact, I am flesh of their flesh, bone of their bone, created by them. My blood, my father's blood is in that soil.
Text, Imitation of Life, 1934. A black woman knocks on the classroom door. A girl with pale skin and smooth, dark hair frowns. She hides her face behind a book as the woman enters and approaches the teacher.
Good afternoon, ma'am. It's raining so hard, I brought Roberts and Colt to fetch my little girl home.
I'm afraid you've made some mistake.
Ain't this the 3B?
Yes.
Well, this is it.
She can't be it. I had no little colored children in my class.
Oh, thank you.
The woman scans the room, then points.
There's my little girl.
Behind the book.
Piola, you may go home.
Her white classmates turn to watch as Piola leaves, her head hanging low.
Gee, I didn't know she was
colored.
Neither did I. I hate you. I hate you. I hate you.
Piola.
She runs past her mother, then out into heavy rain. A portrait of an old black woman wearing an apron. Her head wrapped in a kerchief. She holds a pipe between her lips.
I know very well that my ancestors had no desire to come to this place.
A black woman poses with children, one black and one white.
But neither did the ancestors of the people who became white.
A caption, white and black slaves from New Orleans. Two children, black Isaac and white Rosa.
They require a song of me. Less to celebrate my captivity than to justify their own.
A white boy, Charlie, holds a flag. White men pose at a camp. A black teen sits tucked between the legs of one of them. Chapter title, Purity. In grainy color footage, people shop for groceries among rows of tall shelves.
I've always been struck in America by an emotional poverty so bottomless and a terror of human life, of human touch, so deep that virtually no American appears able to achieve any viable organic connection between his public stance and his private life.
Shoppers file through the dozen checkout lanes. Husbands point to products. Women place them into carts.
This failure of the private life has always had the most devastating effect on American public conduct and on black-white relations. If Americans were not so terrified of their private selves, they would never have become so dependent on what they called the Negro problem.
But they said it wasn't nice to say nigger.
Title, No Way Out, 1950. A white man throws a punch, then stands over the fallen black man.
Poor little nigger kids. Love the little nigger kids. Who loved me?
He holds a gun.
Who loved me?
This problem, which they invented in order to safeguard their purity, has made of them criminals and monsters. And it is destroying them.
A parade.
And this, not from anything blacks may or may not be doing, but because of the role of a guilty and constricted white imagination as assigned to the blacks.
A black majorette struts as a few white passersby look on. A gold-painted shirtless man with kinky hair poses on a float. Text, The Defiant Ones, 1958.
Look, man, don't give me that look. You should have got what was coming to you. After spitting in that guy's face.
Two men, white and black, handcuffed together.
Why, you...
It is impossible to accept the premise of the story. A premise based on the profound American misunderstanding of the nature of the hatred between black and white.
And that time is now.
The men fight.
The root of the black man's hatred is rage. And he does not so much hate white men as simply wants them out of his way. And more than that, out of his children's way.
The white man wraps their shared chain around the black man's throat.
The root of the white man's hatred is terror.
I'm gonna kill you.
A bottomless and nameless terror.
Right.
Which focuses on this dread figure, an entity which lives only in his mind.
Later, the separated men run to catch a moving train. The black man hops aboard, then reaches for his white companion.
Run! Come on! I can't make it.
Their hands meet, then slip apart. The black man jumps off, and the men tumble away together.
When Sidney jumps off the train, the white liberal people downtown were much relieved and joyful. But when black people saw him jump off the train, they yelled, "Get back on the train, you fool!"
Sydney helps the injured white man.
the black man jumps off the train in order to reassure white people, to make them know that they are not hated, that though they have made human errors, they done nothing for which to be hated.
A giant Chiquita banana opens to reveal a dancing black man.
I'm Chiquita Banana, and I'm here to say I am the top banana.
In spite of the fabulous myths proliferating in this country concerning the sexuality of black people, black men are still used in the popular culture as though they had no sexual equipment at all.
In a movie still, Poitier removes his shirt.
Sidney Poitier, as a black artist and a man, is also up against the infantile, furtive sexuality of this country. Both he and Harry Belafonte, for example, are sex symbols, though no one dares admit that, still less to use them as any of the Hollywood he-men are used.
Text, guess who's coming to dinner, 1967. Poitier's character covers his bare chest.
Black people have been robbed of everything in this country.
I got something to say to you, boy.
And they don't want to be robbed of their artists. Black people particularly disliked Guess Who's Coming to Dinner because they felt that Sidney was, in effect, being used against them. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner may prove in some bizarre way to be a milestone because it is really quite impossible to go any further in that particular direction.
In a sketch, an ape-like character lies in bed with a bare-shouldered white woman. A middle-aged black couple stare as if repulsed.
The next time, the kissing will have to start.
Text, in the heat of the night, 1967. A white officer brings a black man to a train station.
Well, got your ticket? Here you are.
The officer hands the man his suitcase.
Thank you.
The men shake hands.
I am aware that men do not kiss each other in American films. Nor, for the most part, in America. Nor do the black detective and the white sheriff kiss here.
The men part ways, then turn back to each other.
You take care. You hear?
The black detective holds the sheriff's gaze, then smiles.
Yeah.
But the obligatory fade-out kiss in the classic American film did not speak of love, and still less of sex. It spoke of reconciliation. Of all things now becoming possible.
Wipers clear a windshield as a car travels in heavy rain. The car travels over an iron trestle bridge. The gray sky and a network of steel beams pass overhead. A sign ahead reads, Exit 46, Manhattan.
I knew a blonde girl in the village a long time ago. And eventually, we never walked out of the house together.
Text, Pressure, 1976.
She was far safer walking the streets alone than when walking with me.
A black man dances with his white girl.
A brutal and humiliating fact which thoroughly destroyed whatever relationship this girl and I might have been able to achieve. This happens all the time in America. But Americans have yet to realize what a sinister fact this is and what it says about them.
A subway train arrives at a station.
When we walked out in the evening then, she would leave ahead of me, alone. I would give about 5 minutes, and then I would walk out alone, taking another route and meet her on the subway platform. We would not acknowledge each other. We would get into the subway car, sitting at opposite ends of it, and walk separately through the streets of the free and the brave to wherever we were going, a friend's house or the movies.
Text, the secret of selling the Negro. We acknowledge with thanks the cooperation of the United States Department of Commerce. In the film, a well-dressed young black family sit in their living room.
All over the country, families such as this are enjoying new prosperity. They have new interests, new standards of living, a buying power they've never enjoyed before. There are good prospects for practically all types of goods and services. All too often, though, they are overlooked prospects. Since 1940, in San Francisco alone, the Negro market has increased by 89%.
A girl skips to the dinner table.
Here are millions of customers for what you have to sell. Customers with $15 billion to spend.
A husband writes a check.
Someone once said to me that the people in general cannot bear very much reality. He meant by this that they prefer fantasy to a truthful recreation of their experience. The people have quite enough reality to bear by simply getting through their lives, raising their children, dealing with the eternal conundrums of birth, taxes, and death.
Robert Kennedy.
Negroes are continuously making progress here in this country. The progress in many areas is not as fast as it should be, but they are making progress, and we will continue to make progress. There's no reason that in the foreseeable future that a Negro could also be president of the United States.
James Baldwin.
I remember, for example, when the ex-attorney general, Mr. Robert Kennedy...
Text, Cambridge University debate, 1965.
...that it was conceivable that in 40 years in America we might have a Negro president. And that sounded like a very emancipated statement, I suppose, to white people.
He shrugs.
They were not in Harlem when this statement was first heard, and did not hear, and possibly will never hear, the laughter and the bitterness and the scorn which the statement was greeted. From the point of view of the man in the Harlem barbershop, Bobby Kennedy only got here yesterday. And now he's already on his way to the presidency. We've been here for 400 years, and now he tells us that maybe in 40 years, if you're good, we may let you become president.
It was a dream, just a dream I had on my mind.
In a black and white photo, a young black man stands by an American flag at a rally. Another man confronts the camera as the crowd around him faces forward. A black woman stands under an umbrella, gazing somberly. A young girl holds a small flag.
And when I woke up, baby, not a thing could I find.
In modern footage, President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama walk in an inaugural parade waving to supporters.
And had a good time. I dreamed I was satisfied and nothing to worry my mind, but it was a dream. Just a dream I had on my mind.
Chapter title, Selling the Negro at the Cambridge University debate.
Let me put it this way, that from a very literal point of view, the harbors and the ports and the railroads of the country.
A black woman draws water from a well.
The economy, especially of the southern states, could not conceivably be what it has become if they had not had and do not still have, indeed, and for so long, so many generations, cheap labor.
Black workers harvest cotton. Words appear. For sale, at 11 o'clock on Monday under the trees, a large lot of Negroes accustomed to the culture of cotton. Hannibal, 24 years old, good character. Lavinda, 20 years. Prince, a driver, 27 years. Betsy, a nurse, 40 years. Infant, 9 months. $1,270. We will sell without reserve. Terms, cash. In mid-century footage, a black man dances a jig as a band plays. He slides and shuffles his feet on the floor.
It is a terrible thing for an entire people to surrender to the notion that 1/9 of its population is beneath them. And until that moment, until the moment comes when we, the American people, are able to accept the fact that I have to accept, for example, that my ancestors are both white and black, that on that continent we are trying to forge a new identity for which we need each other, and that I am not a ward of America. I'm not an object of missionary charity. I am one of the people who built the country. Until this moment, there is scarcely any hope for the American dream. because the people who are denied participation in it, by their very presence, will wreck it. And if that happens, it's a very grave moment for the West. Thank you.
Hundreds of young men and women, mostly white, rise to their feet as they applaud. Baldwin takes his seat, glancing up at the tribute surrounding him. Marchers carry signs. America has a century-old debt to pay. Thousands gather at the foot of the Washington Monument. A white man dips his feet into the reflecting pool at the Lincoln Memorial. His sign reads, "We march for effective civil rights laws now." Demonstrators of all colors shout and smile joyfully. Among them, Bob Dylan, Harry Belafonte, Marlon Brando, Sidney Poitier, Sammy Davis Jr., and James Baldwin.
We're here in the studio today with seven men who have two things in common.
Text, Hollywood Roundtable, August 1963.
And they've all come to Washington. They're seven out of some 200,000 American citizens who came to the Capitol to march for freedom and for jobs. Will this tremendous outburst now lead to a course of action, Mr. Belafonte?
The now that is being spoken about is the fact that in 100 years, finally, through whatever the causes have been in history, and most of them have been because of oppression, the Negro people have strongly and fully taken the bit in their teeth. They're asking absolutely no quarter from anyone. But I do say that the bulk of the interpretation of whether this thing is going to end successfully and joyously or is going to end disastrously lays very heavily with the white community. It lays very heavily with the profiteers. It lays very heavily with the vested interests. It lays very heavily with a great middle stream in this country of people who have refused to commit themselves or even have the slightest knowledge that these things have been going on.
Streetlights glow as the sun sets behind a commercial strip. We drive past a car sales lot, a tire store, a liquor store, a gas station, and an Arby's.
I am speaking as a member of a certain democracy in very complex country, which insists on being very narrow-minded. Simplicity is taken to be a great American virtue, along with sincerity.
Footage superimposes over the street scene.
I am deeply sorry.
And I'm sorry.
I am deeply sorry about
that. And
there
are no excuses.
I am sorry.
You've made plenty of mistakes.
For that, I apologize.
I am very sorry.
You know, I'm sorry I did this to you, but you got to get used to it. It's one of those little problems in life.
I take full responsibility.
I'm here today to again apologize.
I'm just apologizing for that to her.
For any mistakes I have made, I take full responsibility. It's an honor to serve the city of Ferguson and the people who live there.
We drive past a Kessler, a parking garage, and an antenna tower.
One of the results of this is that immaturity is taken to be a virtue, too. So that someone like that, let's say, John Wayne, who spent most of his time on screen admonishing Indians, was in no necessity to grow up.
In a movie still, an Indian woman recoils from Wayne's character.
I had been in London on this particular night. We were free, and we decided to treat ourselves to a really fancy, friendly dinner.
Cars drive in the rain.
The head waiter came and said there was a phone call for me. My sister Gloria rose to take it.
In a photo, Baldwin smiles with a woman.
She was very strange when she came back. She didn't say anything. And I began to be afraid to ask her anything.
Rain falls on a pond.
Then, nibbling at something she obviously wasn't tasting, she said, "Well, I've got to tell you because the press is on its way over here. They have just killed Malcolm."
Malcolm's body lies on a stretcher, eyes closed, mouth agape. A headline, "Malcolm X murdered, gunned down at rally." Now in a casket, he lies swathed in white, his Ray-Ban eyeglasses gone. A line of mourners form on a sidewalk, held back by police barriers. A uniformed woman stands guard as mourners file past the open casket. A glass pane lies over the casket's opening. On the Dick Cavett Show.
There is nothing in the evidence offered by the Book of the American Republic.
A white man holds a sign, segregation forever.
Which allows me really to argue with a cat who says to me, they needed us to pick the cotton, and now they don't need us anymore. And now they don't need us, they're gonna kill us all off, just like they did the Indians. And I can't say it's a Christian nation.
A sign. Who needs niggers?
They were, your brothers will never do that to you because the record is too long and too bloody. That's all we have done. All your buried corpses now begin to speak.
Text. H. Rapp Brown, Black Panther Party, July 1967.
Violence is a part of America's culture. It is as American as cherry pie.
Black power, brothers.
He raises his fist. A white bandage stands out against his brown forehead. Text, Oakland, 1968. Police and helmets use rifles to push back a crowd of black protesters. Some swing their batons at the fleeing crowd. A man lies on a littered sidewalk holding his face. Others hold their hands up as they walk. Another man lies on the ground. A man gestures and yells at an unseen enemy as his friends hold him back. With Dick Cavett.
If we were white, if we were Irish, if we were Jewish, if we were Poles, if we had, in fact, in your mind, a frame of reference, our heroes would be your heroes too. Nat Turner would be a hero for you instead of a threat. Malcolm X might still be alive. And it, you know, everyone is very proud of brave little Israel, a state against which I have nothing. You know, I don't want to be misinterpreted. I'm not an anti-Semite. But, you know, when the Israelis pick up guns, or the Poles, or the Irish, or any white man in the world says, give me liberty or give me death, the entire white world applauds. When a black man says exactly the same thing, word for word, he is judged a criminal and treated like one, and everything possible is done to make an example of this bad nigger so there won't be any more like him.
Text, The Land We Love.
Look out across this land we love.
A U.S. government film, 1960.
There's unending scenic beauty, and there's freedom. It's an inherent American right, meaning many different things to every single citizen.
A football game.
It's a leisurely afternoon of golf along a pleasant course. It's an amusement park, a roller coaster ride. A day at a county fair.
A horse dives into a pool. Now, buildings burn.
A day of excitement.
Text, Watts protests, Los Angeles, August 1965.
Unlimited enjoyment of all these jewels in the continent's crown.
Police carry a black man by the neck.
For all of us, there's all of America, all of its scenic beauty.
A cop points his rifle against a man's head. Another shoves a man who throws a punch. The cop whips the man repeatedly with his baton.
We've dropped too many bombs on Vietnam now.
Martin Luther King Jr.
Let us save our national honor. Stop the bombing and stop the war.
In a photo, Baldwin smirks at his brother.
What I am trying to say to this country, to us, is that we must know this.
In advertisements, white people smile and take pictures of each other.
That no other country in the world have been so fat and so sleek and so safe and so happy and so irresponsible and so dead. No other country can afford to dream of a Plymouth and a wife and a house with a fence and the children growing up safely to go to college and to become executives and then to marry and have the Plymouth and the house and so forth. A great many people do not live this way and cannot imagine it and do not know that when we talk about democracy, this is what we mean.
A black father and an Asian mother pose with their daughters among a sea of white families. People dance and mug on the Gong Show. Panelist Jamie Farr dances with a blonde woman.
The industry is compelled, given the way it is built, to present to the American people a self-perpetuating fantasy of American life. Their concept of entertainment is difficult to distinguish from the use of narcotics.
What worries you about them having black partners? Do you think people are going to look down on them or judge
them?
Yes,
I think people look down.
A talk show audience jeers. On another show, a black man gets down on one knee before a woman. On another show, a man and woman fight, grabbing at each other's hair.
To watch the TV screen for any length of time is to learn some really frightening things about the American sense of reality.
Game show contestants jump.
We are cruelly trapped between what we would like to be and what we actually are. And we cannot possibly become what we would like to be until we are willing to ask ourselves just why the lives we lead on this continent are mainly so empty, so tame, and so ugly.
Confetti rains down on a winner.
These images are designed not to trouble, but to reassure. They also weaken our ability to deal with the world as it is. Ourselves as we are.
TV audiences react. Dick Cavett.
I would like to add someone to our group here. Professor Paul Weiss, a Sterling Professor of Philosophy at Yale.
Weiss shakes hands with Cavett, Baldwin, and a female guest as he joins them on the set. He takes the seat beside Cavett's desk.
Were you able to listen to the show backstage?
A good deal of it, but then I was behind the...
Yes.
So I heard only some of it.
Did you hear anything that you disagreed with?
I disagreed with a great deal of it. And, of course, it's a good deal I agree with. But I think he's overlooking one very important matter, I think. Each one of us, I think, is terribly alone. He lives his own individual life. He has all kinds of obstacles in the way of religion or color or size or shape or lack of ability. And the problem is to become a man.
But what I was discussing was not that problem, really. I was discussing the difficulties, the obstacles, the very real danger of death thrown up by the society when a Negro, when a black man attempts to become a man.
All this emphasis upon black man and white does emphasize something which is here, but it emphasizes it or perhaps exaggerates it, and therefore makes us put people together in groups which they ought not to be in. I have more in common with a black scholar than I have with a white man who's against scholarship. And you have more in common with a white author than you have with someone who's against all literature. So why must we always concentrate on color or on religion or this? There are other ways of connecting men.
I'll tell you this. When I left this country in 1948, I left this country for one reason only, one reason. I didn't care where I went. I might have gone to Hong Kong, I might have gone to Timbuktu. I ended up in Paris, on the streets of Paris, with $40 in my pocket on the theory that nothing worse could happen to me there than it already happened to me here. You talk about making it as a writer by yourself. You had to be able then to turn up all the antenna with which you live, because once you turn your back on this society, you may die. You may die. And it's very hard to sit at a typewriter and concentrate on that if you're afraid of the world around you. The years I lived in Paris did one thing for me. They released me from that particular social terror, which was not the paranoia of my own mind, but a real social danger visible in the face of every cop, every boss, everybody.
In a photo, black men, stripped to their underwear, line up against a building, hands cuffed behind their backs.
I don't know what most white people in this country feel, but I can only include what they feel from the state of their institutions. I don't know if white Christians hate Negroes or not, but I know that we have a Christian church which is white and a Christian church which is black. I know, as Malcolm X once put it, it's the most segregated hour in American life is high noon on Sunday. That says a great deal for me about a Christian nation. It means that I can't afford to trust most white Christians and certainly cannot trust the Christian church. I don't know whether the labor unions and their bosses really hate me. That doesn't matter, but I know I'm not in their unions. I don't know if the real estate lobby is anything against black people, but I know the real estate lobbies keep me in the ghetto. I don't know if the Board of Education hates black people, but I know the textbooks they give my children to read and the schools that we have to go to. Now, this is the evidence. You want me to make an act of faith, risking myself, my wife, my woman, my sister, my children, on some idealism which you assure me exists in America, which I have never seen.
Text, Uncle Tom's Cabin, 1927. A white woman and her smiling slaves carry bouquets of flowers.
All of the Western nations have been caught in a lie. The lie of their pretended humanism.
Little black children dance around the white woman.
This means that their history has no moral justification, and that the West has no moral authority.
Words appear. Mr. and Mrs. Shelby, whose gentle rule of the slaves was typical of the South.
Vile as I am, states one of the characters in Dostoevsky's The Idiot, I don't believe in the wagons that bring bread to humanity. For the wagons that bring bread to humanity may coldly exclude a considerable part of humanity from enjoying what is brought.
In The Pajama Game, 1957, young white people dance and cartwheel through a picnic.
America prospered. This prosperity cost millions of people their lives. Now, not even the people who are the most spectacular recipients of the benefits of this prosperity are able to endure these benefits. They can neither understand them nor do without them. Above all, they cannot imagine the price paid by their victims or subjects for this way of life. And so they cannot afford to know why the victims are revolting.
In modern footage, riot police fire tear gas. An officer tackles a woman, throwing her to the ground. An officer pummels a man on the ground. In many more scenes, three to four officers surround and brutally take down a single person.
This is the formula for a nation or kingdom decline.
Martin points to a bullet hole in a window.
For no kingdom can maintain itself by force alone. Force does not work the way its advocates think, in fact, it does.
In Custer of the West, 1967, cavalrymen shoot Indians.
It does not, for example, reveal to the victim the strength of the adversary.
Men tear the clothing from an Indian woman. In a historical photo, bodies lie on a plain.
On the contrary, it reveals the weakness, even the panic, of the adversary.
Text, Wounded Knee Massacre, 1890.
And this revelation invests the victim with passion.
In another photo, bodies fill a mass grave. Now, palm trees' long leafy fronds form umbrella-shaped canopies overhead.
There is a day in Palm Springs that I will remember forever. A bright day. I was based in Hollywood working on the screen version of the autobiography of Malcolm X. This was a difficult assignment. Since I had known Malcolm after all, crossed swords with him, worked with him, and held him in that great esteem which is not easily distinguishable, if it is distinguishable, from love.
Malcolm takes a picture of Muhammad Ali at a lunch counter.
Billy D. Williams had come to town and he was staying at the house. I very much wanted Billy D. for the role of Malcolm.
A swimming pool reflects the blue sky.
Phone had been brought out to the pool and now it rang. And I picked it up. The record player was still playing.
Ripples of sunlight dance across the bottom of the pool.
He's not dead yet. But it's a head wound.
Robert Kennedy.
I have some very sad news for all of you. And I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
In a photo, Martin carries a briefcase on a motel's second floor balcony, his brow creased.
I hardly remember the rest of the evening at all. I remember weeping briefly, more in helpless rage than in sorrow, and Billy trying to comfort me. But I really don't remember that evening at all.
Mother dear, may I go downtown?
In black and white footage, crowds run through a street. Guardsmen hold rifles as they patrol in a jeep. Smoke pours from the crumbled ruins of a building. Hundreds walk silently, carrying signs. Honor King. End racism. Thousands watch as horses pull a casket. Coretta Scott King follows behind, accompanied by her children, Jesse Jackson, and thousands more.
And march the streets of Birmingham to make my country free.
At the church, she leans over the open casket.
The church was packed. In the pew before me sat Marlon Brando, Sammy Davis, Eartha Kitt, Sidney Poitier nearby. I saw Harry Belafonte sitting next to Coretta King.
A tear runs down Belafonte's cheek.
I have a childhood handover thing about not weeping in public, and I was concentrating on holding myself together. I did not want to weep for Martin. Tears seemed futile. But I may also have been afraid, and I could not have been the only one, that if I began to weep, I would not be able to stop. I started to cry, and I stumbled. Sammy grabbed my arm.
A woman's eyes brim with tears.
The story of the Negro in America is the story of America. It is not a pretty story.
Baldwin stands among a building's ruins.
What can we do?
New York, today.
Well, I am tired. I don't know how it will come about. I know that no matter how it comes about, it will be bloody. It will be hard. I still believe that we can do with this country something that has not been done before. We are misled here because we think of numbers. You don't need numbers. You need passion. And this is proven by the history of the world. The tragedy is that most of the people who say they care about it do not care. What they care about is their safety and their profits.
When I was laying in jail with my back to the city wall.
An enormous electronic billboard displays Bloomberg financial figures, now old mugshots of white and black men. Today, a chain link gate opens. A handcuffed man steps out of a van.
The American way of life has failed to make people happier or make them better. We do not want to admit this. And we do not admit it. We persist in believing that the empty and criminal among our children are the result of some miscalculation in the formula that can be corrected. That the bottomless and aimless hostility which makes our cities among the most dangerous in the world is created and felt by a handful of aberrants. That the lack, yawning everywhere in this country, of passionate conviction, of personal authority, proves only our rather appealing tendency to be gregarious and democratic.
Headlines, shooting, 33 dead.
To look around the United States today is enough to make prophets and angels weep.
Senseless, massacring 26 people.
This is not the land of the free. It is only very unwillingly and sporadically the home of the brave.
Text, Elephant, 2003. A young man walks casually through a library as classmates fall. A boy stands and puts his hands in the air. Another takes a picture.
I sometimes feel it to be an absolute miracle that the entire black population of the United States of America has not long ago succumbed to raging paranoia. People finally say to you, in an attempt to dismiss the social reality, "But you're so bitter."
In grainy, distant footage, officers beat a man on the ground with their batons as more watch. Text, Rodney King beating, Los Angeles, 1991.
I may or may not be bitter. But if I were, I would have good reasons for it. Chief among them, that American blindness or cowardice which allows us to pretend that life presents no reasons for being bitter.
Officers close in as the man tries to get up. Text, Love in the Afternoon, 1957. Musicians play in an opulent parlor. A man dances cheek to cheek with a woman in a white fur coat.
In this country, for a dangerously long time, there have been two levels of experience. One, to put it cruelly, can be summed up in the images of Gary Cooper and Doris Day. Two of the most grotesque appeals to innocence the world has ever seen.
Lullaby of Broadway.
And the other, subterranean, indispensable, and denied, can be summed up, let us say, in the tone and in the face of Ray Charles.
Ooh, mama, don't you treat me wrong. Come and love me, daddy, all night long.
He nods and sways as he sings at a piano.
When you see me in misery, come on, baby, say what I mean.
And there had never been any genuine confrontation between these two levels of experience.
Text, Lover Come Back, 1961.
Should I be bad or nice?
Doris Day, her blonde hair in a bouffant, holds
Should
a bottle of champagne.
I surrender. His pleading words so tenderly.
She gets two glasses.
And treat me. Is this the night that love?
She stares dreamily.
Finally.
In a photo, a black woman hangs by the neck from a tree.
You cannot lynch me and keep me in ghettos without becoming something monstrous yourselves.
White men gather around a lynched man.
And furthermore, you give me a terrifying advantage.
A blindfolded man hangs.
You never had to look at me. I had to look at you. I know more about you than you know about me. Not everything that is faced can be changed. But nothing can be changed until it is faced.
Over a dozen men pose with the corpse. One turns away from the camera. Chapter title, I Am Not a Nigger.
History is not the past. It is the present. We carry our history with us. We are our history. If we pretend otherwise, we literally are criminals.
A black man gazes up at the American flag he carries.
I attest to this. The world is not white.
19th century portraits of black families, workers, and individuals
cannot be white. White is a metaphor for power. And that is simply a way of describing Chase Manhattan Bank.
More well-dressed black families pose in studio portraits. Today, black adults pose individually and in groups by a stone wall. Men and women somberly confront the camera. A pair of men. Five women stand together. A group of six, young and old, stand together. A young woman stares straight ahead. She wears large hoop earrings and a crucifix pendant. Her dark braided hair is pulled back. Now, James Baldwin.
I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive. To be a pessimist means that you have agreed that human life is an academic matter. So I'm forced to be an optimist. I'm forced to believe that we can survive whatever we must survive. But
he looks down, thoughtfully.
The Negro in this country, the future of the Negro in this country is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of the country. It is entirely up to the American people and our representatives. It is entirely up to the American people whether or not they're going to face and deal with and embrace this stranger whom they maligned so long. What white people have to do is try to find out in their own hearts why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place. Because I'm not a nigger. I'm a man. But if you think I'm a nigger, it means you need him. The question you've got to ask yourself, the white population of this country has got to ask itself, north and south, because it's one country, and for a Negro, there is no difference in the north and the south. There's just, you know, a difference in the way they castrate you. But the fact of the castration is the American fact. If I'm not the nigger here, and you invented him, you, the white people, invented him, then you got to find out why. And the future of the country depends on that, whether or not it's able to ask that question.
Baldwin glances at the audience, then away.
I saw them shit like a slave, can be black. Boy, we feel one heap of pain, can be black. I'm an asset of put me in a chain, can be black.
Credits.
Me go a chain full of rocks, and you know see the whip, left side from the back. But now we have a big whip back from the black. All them are so redoomed from the start, can be black. Remember this, heavy rain start from the black. Just remember that.
I'm the biggest hypocrite in 2015. Once I finish this, witnesses will convey just what I mean. I mean, it's evident that I'm irrelevant to society. That's what you're telling me. Penitentiary would only hire me. Curse me till I'm dead. Church me with your fake prophesizing that I'ma be just another slave in my head. Institutionalized manipulation and lies. Reciprocation of freedom only live in your eyes. You hate me, don't you? I know you hate me just as much as you hate yourself. Jealous of my wisdom and cards I dealt. Watching me as I pull up, fill up my tank, then peel out. Muscle cars like pull-ups, show you what these big wheels about. I, black and successful, this black man meant to be special. Cat scans on my radar, bitch, how can I help you? How can I tell you I'm making a killing? You make me a killer, emancipation of a real nigga.
I saw them shit like a slave, can be black. Boy, we feel one heap of pain, can be black. I'm an asset of put me in a chain, can be black. I'm a chain now, me go a chain full of rocks. And you know see the whip, left side from the back. But now we have a big whip back from the black. All them are super doom from the start, can be black. But remember this, heavy rain start from the black. Just remember that.
I'm the biggest hypocrite in 2015. When I finish this, if you listen, then sure you will agree. This plot is bigger than me. Generational hatred, it's cynicism, it's grimy little justification. I'm African American, I'm African, I'm black as the heart of a fucking Aryan. I'm black as the name of Tyrone and Darius. Excuse my French, but fuck you, no fuck y'all. That's as blunt as it gets. I know you hate me, don't you? You hate my people, I can tell cause there's threats when I see you. I can tell cause your waist is evil. No, I can tell because you in love with the desert eagle. Thinking maliciously, he get a chain then you gon' bleed him. It's funny how Zulu and Thosa might go to war. Two tribal armies that wanna build and destroy. Remind me of these Compton Crip gangs that live next door. Beefing with Pyrus, only death settled the score. So no matter how much I say I like to preach with the Panthers, or tell Georgia State Marcus Garvey got all the answers, or try to celebrate February like it's my B-Day, or eat watermelon chicken and Kool-Aid on weekdays, or jump high enough to get Michael Jordan endorsements, or watch BET cause urban support is important. So why did I weep when Trayvon Martin was in the street, when gangbanging make me kill a nigga blacker than me? Hypocrite.
With the voice of Samuel L. Jackson. Edited by Alexandra Strauss. Archival research, Maria Elaine Barberis, assisted by Nolan Gu. Animation and graphics, Michelle Bluestein. Director of photography, Henry Adebonojo, Bill and Turner Ross. Music composed by Alexei Agui. Sound design, Valerie Ledoc and David Gion. Produced by Remy Greletti, Raoul Peck, and Hebert Peck. Co-produced by Patrick Kine and Joel Bertosa. With the full support and collaboration of the James Baldwin Estate, Gloria Karifa Smart, and Eileen Ahern. James Baldwin material compiled and edited by Raoul Peck, a Raoul Peck film. Thanks to James Baldwin, the visionary, poet, and humanist for his unconditional voice. Copyright 2016, Velvet Film Incorporated, Velvet Film SAS, Artemis Productions, Close-Up Films, Arte France, RTS, and RTBF.